Oh, it's nice to be here with you again. Wow, I just have to say that sermon talk title for next week, that might be the best sermon title I've ever heard, I think. Incredible. Thanks so much for letting me be a part of your gathering here today, speaking to you as a community today, and I'm super privileged to join with you. And, you know, last time I was here, I was invited by the beautiful Claire to come and talk to you about climate change and really our response to climate change, acknowledging that many of us might be on different paths with this. And I spoke about naming some of the things that we may experience as we grapple with our changing world, and about how action can bring hope and it can also fight despair. Well, here we are, 3.5 years later, and we're still in need of hope, aren't we? We're still in need of fighting despair. And, you know, sometimes I like to start a talk with a really happy story, but I just didn't quite have one for this sermon today, so bear with me. But, you know, our hearts break probably this week if you've heard about the hundreds of immigrants who perished off the coast of Greece this week and the refugee crisis that continues to grow. But in a world not far from now, those numbers could continue to grow exponentially as parts of our planet with very large populations become increasingly hotter and impossible to live in. We ourselves might have already wondered what it might be like for us in Perth in 10 or 20 years' time, in our summer times. Will we one day be people who have to migrate to avoid extreme heat? How might future food systems work when extreme weather pushes unstable governments over the edge and stable governments to crisis point? How might our ecological system be diminished when key species move closer to extinction and continue to upset that balance in our natural world? How does our planet hurtle towards 10 billion people when we know that around every corner is a dying river, an ocean garbage patch, an oil spill killing a local community? How do we keep growing when growth means death for another human, another species, another forest, another ecosystem? I remember years ago, my aunt, I think I was probably about 16 or 17, and let's face it, I did enjoy cooking, but she gave us our Christmas gifts. And she'd never been a particularly terrible Christmas gift giver before, but they could also be quite random. But myself and my sister quite enjoyed our gifts from her, because often it was, you know, the freebie from a makeup purchase. So we'd get the mini lipstick or the mini mascara or whatever, and we quite enjoyed that. But one year she was clearly off her game because I received this wrapped present about this long, skinny. I couldn't figure out what it could be, and it looked very different from anything I'd ever gotten from her before. And I opened it and it was a wooden spoon. But it wasn't a new wooden spoon, because you could see the line, the bottom of it was quite black, you know, the way your spoon at home might be if it had been sitting in the jar for many years. And I'm not quite sure what had happened, whether she'd just had an off day or had forgotten my present. But that was my gift from my aunt that year. But, you know, that's the gift we've kind of left for future generations, haven't we? A gift that is not quite what it needs to be, what it should be. And, you know, it's quite both a historical and yet very contemporary problem, because half of all emissions have occurred after 1990. So it's very much our issue, our problem. And in a sense, the conundrum that we face is that 8 billion people who are living on planet Earth, and increasingly at the scale of the richest and most wasteful 10%. Just recently, you may have heard of some of these things. El Nino has just been declared a planet-warming weather phase that may increase temperatures in many places around the world in coming months and into next year, despite the last few months breaking all sorts of heat records already. Shell has just announced that they've decided to keep oil output steady or slightly higher into 2030 as part of the CEO's efforts to regain investor confidence as the energy giant wrestles with poor returns from renewables while oil and gas profits are booming. The Washington Post tells us that ocean warming anomalies, that there's a steady and remarkable rise in the average global ocean temperatures this year that's now outpacing anything seen in four decades of satellite observations, causing many scientists to suddenly blare alarms over the risks and realities of climate change. And the Antarctic sea ice is at its lowest since records began, 40% lower than the long-term average. And the thing is, these are environmental issues, and they are part of the climate catastrophe we face right now. But they're not exactly the same thing. It's a massive conceptual error that we would simplistically equate the climate crisis with environmental issues. It's so much deeper and broader and fuller than that. We are here not just because there are some environmental issues, but because of the underlying logic of the entirety of human civilization. And the fact remains and becomes ever more possible every day that we really might be stupid enough to destroy our only home. We really might be okay with corporate and individual greed enough to let profits and lifestyle dictate the demise of a livable planet. And it seems that we've fallen ill, if you like, to a societal stuckness that keeps us trapped in this way of living that we cannot and we do not want to get out of. But becoming unstuck is the language of revelation, of epiphany, of spiritual practice and growth. It's the language of faith and spirituality. We need to get stuck at scale and quickly, and it requires a spiritual response. A climate scientist said the following: I used to think that top global environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought that with 30 years of good science, we could address these problems. But I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with these, we need a spiritual and cultural transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do that. The problem is, some days I'm not sure if I have the faith and vision for such a grand and impossible task. I don't know about you. Being a Christian is often nothing but having faith and hope in the times that don't make sense. But this task is truly enormous. During my theological studies, I always found it uncomfortably bizarre talking about evangelism and the growth of Christianity throughout the centuries, because there were, throughout those centuries, incredible people and incredible communities of extraordinary light and love who truly were used by God to usher in a better way, to preach the gospel that Jesus is alive and Jesus is Lord, in order for their fellow humans to know their great worth as human beings, and that the hope for the world would be that all of creation could be reconciled back to God. And yet, for all of Christianity's growth and explosion, for all the billions who call themselves followers of Christ, why have we truly done so little to usher in a new world full of the love of God and full of care for creation? Why are we still in a place where the wealthy and the powerful hold all the cards, where unbelievable cruelty and slavery and oppression still thrive in our world, and even our best political systems seem sometimes not so much more than a puppet show, so fossil fuel conglomerates can keep drilling and fracking and blasting and destroying our fragile home. I know for some this might feel distasteful. Surely Christianity is a message of hope, and we should focus on that. But it's also a good time to remember that the foreboding of doom occupies a rather large part of the terrain of the Bible. How can we understand the prophets if we don't understand that they've seen disaster approaching, the natural consequences of that human sin? And yet they must watch their people plunge merrily and optimistically into the jaws of crisis, in denial of the inevitable until it comes to pass. I read once, not long ago, that Jeremiah is the prophet for our time. And I really think now I understand what that means. Jeremiah was a prophet who was called to warn Israel of the consequences of breaking their covenant with God as they practiced idolatry and allowed injustice to flourish. He was trying to get the people to turn away from their sin and return to God. And there's a heart-rending moment where the prophet proclaims a powerful hope that disaster can yet be averted. And in chapter 6, verse 16, it says, "Stand at the crossroads and look and ask for the ancient paths where the good ways lie, and walk in it and find rest for your souls." But in the very next statement, that hope is dashed. "But," they said, "we will not give heed." And Jeremiah is tormented by a grief that has multiple dimensions. He has grief over the future he glimpsed for the people he loves. He has grief that he must be the one to speak of it to the people who don't want to hear. He has grief that he has seen how doom can be averted and yet has to watch the willful denial of his people, the refusal to alter the course that they have set for themselves. If we go back just into chapter 5, verse 25, "Your wrongdoing has upset nature's order, and your sins have kept away her bounty." I think it's good to remember, though, that the biblical witness has fully looked into the face of human darkness and noted all of humanity's inhumaneness that we continue to witness today. Where does that leave us, though? If, like Jeremiah, we feel the darkness of doom around the corner, where do we find hope and purpose in this current conundrum? Well, I'd like to move to the words of Jesus in John chapter 17. And in the verses 20 to 23, I'd just like to read that. "I ask not only on behalf of these, but also on behalf of those who will believe in me through their word, that they may also be one." They may all be one, sorry. "As you, Father, are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given them, so that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me, that they may become completely one, so that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them even as you loved me." Now, this section of John is reasonably clear in its meaning, with Jesus praying for all believers that they would be one, that they would be in unity. And we often refer to this passage as a call to unity, to remind Christians that even though we may have different ways of doing things and different doctrines, that we should aim for agreement and to love each other in unity regardless. And I don't wish to challenge that orthodoxy of interpretation, but to simply look at this prayer of Jesus in light of the climate crisis and what Christians could really bring to this catastrophe we face right now. Because humans are in desperate need of reimagining our identity to one that is collective, to one that is global, and yet still connected to the individual's sense of agency and purpose as well. Humans are in desperate need of learning to walk in a love that is powerful enough to contend with the patterns of power which are at the heart of the climate struggle. And I wonder if Jesus, as he prayed these prayers in the lead up to his crucifixion, where he would come face to face with these same patterns of power and oppression that govern the planet today, may have had in mind his followers who would be so wanting and willing to be one that they could feel the slowing of the heartbeats of the child dying in Somalia in 2023 because of drought and famine, that they could hear the cry of the orangutan in the Amazon as her home is bulldozed and taking it with it any chance of her survival. As in so many times throughout history when hope was thin, I think Jesus' prayer is that we as Christ followers continue to be courageous in hope and love in order to rediscover in ourselves and reintroduce to those around us who have lost it the interconnectedness between us and every other living thing, human, animal, forest, ocean. To hear the call of life all around us, to be evangelists for the world that Jesus prayed for. So how do we become these evangelists, if you like, of oneness? Some of the things that we can do, I think probably many of you are already doing some of these things. But to be these evangelists of oneness, of interconnectedness, the first thing I want to talk about is claiming a rich theology of earth care, of understanding that we believe and embody the dream God had that humanity would serve as custodians and keepers of the earth, caring for it and only ever drawing from it in a wise, sustainable and manageable way. That we know and we proclaim that the earth is good because it is the handiwork of God. It's an essential part of the creation that serves valuable purpose in the plan and economy of God. That the earth is sacred because it contains a revelation of God and has a relationship with God. Both the existence and personal characteristics of God are made known through what God has made. That the earth is home to both human and non-human life forms that require our sustainable stewardship. We depend on Mother Earth for our survival. That the earth should matter to us because it matters to God. Humanity holds a special place in the heart of God, but not an exclusive place. As Psalm 145 verses 9 to 10 says, his compassion is over all that he has made. And added to this, in the covenant God makes with those who survive the flood in Genesis 9, the commitment is to every living creature. And this is repeated 5 times in 9 verses, just in case we didn't get the message. Every living creature. The point is that God cares deeply about the earth and everything, not just everyone in it. And then we let that eco-theology lead us to recover a Christian political economy, living out and advocating for an alternative economic vision for the world. At the end of the day, our love for God, our love for people and for planet can only lead us further and further away from a lifestyle of consumption and wealth creation. And along the way, we contend with all the dark parts of ourselves that just want to have more than the earth can actually give us. And this is about contending with self, who we are in response for this conundrum. What is our responsibility and how do we respond? The second thing that I would love to remind us of as we think about how we can be evangelists for oneness and interconnectedness is to utilize the power of story. Advocacy and activism is such an important part of what we can do as Christians. But I also just feel like so much of where we're at right now is just about, within relationship, telling our stories to our families and friends, telling the story of how you came to care about God's creation. It's an authentic, it's a powerful way of sharing with others the importance of combating climate change, starting with common values, starting with places of shared belief that builds trust and also shows that your concern around climate change comes from the same building blocks. I have a number of people in my family who do not believe in climate change whatsoever, and a few others that believe that it's not, that humans have nothing to do with it. And it's a constant dance to be thinking about how I can share from my heart, from my story, from my testimony, in terms of having those conversations within relationship and ensuring that we can maybe take a little step forward. It might be also a step back, but doing that within the power of story and the power of our own experiences. The next thing that I'd love us to consider as we continue to be evangelists of oneness and interconnectedness is just to believe in the quiet, cumulative effect of faithful advocacy. And making that story and testimony the biggest part of that advocacy, because facts are important, and keeping up to date with some of the basics of the science within our capacity and how it's affecting our world in real time is important. But here we need to remember again that it's not primarily a failure of understanding science that has held back action on climate change. It's a failure to build that moral framework to create and sustain action. It goes without saying that systemic advocacy and activism is something we'll always be involved in as Christ followers who are concerned about where we are right now. And just as an aside, your email phone call will always be an essential part of that cumulative effort. But I think being just committed to that long haul, to those conversations, to those relationships, to that building of interconnectedness and oneness. The next thing that I want to remind us of is simply cultivating community resilience. As it becomes more and more likely that our way of life will change significantly at some stage, then one of the key things that we can do is build communities of resilience. Know your neighbours. Participate in small local economy as much as practical. Be one with your neighbours, not just your faith community. And the next thing I want to remind us of is simply practicing oneness. When was the last time that you had time to sit still in the bush or near the ocean and let the natural world simply flood over you? We all probably have different spiritual practices according to what we find helpful to connect with God and with ourselves. But I encourage you to get out into nature and remember just how connected we are to every element of life around us. Pray and listen. What are your conversations, your dreams, your time in nature, the still small voice of God? What are they telling you in this moment? If we could see our interconnectedness, I imagine it would look a little like a fabric, threads running between each one of us and every person on whom our lives depend, threads tracing the path from each of us to each non-human creature that interacts with our life, the food on our table, the tree that we smile at in every morning, the bird that sings us awake. Still more threads travelling from each of those creatures to all of the creatures on which they depend, their pollinators, their food, their earthworms that till the soil. As we continue to contend with the uncertainties that are ahead of us, there are many things that we have no control over. But each one of us have the ability to be agents of oneness, working alongside God to weave connectedness back into our communities. And this, I believe, is what Jesus was and is praying for still. A prayer for all of us. Creator God, breath and source of life, in love you called the world into being, and in grace you made us and call us your children. We stand in awe of the wonder of your creation, its beauty and wildness, complexity and power, resilience and fragility. God of life, you call us to be participants in the web and wellspring of life, to be nurtured by the planet, to be nurturing of the planet, to cherish the world and all that lives. But we have failed and creation groans under our weight. God of grace, forgive us in our brokenness when we have taken too much from the earth, when we have not spoken out against greed and destruction, when we have allowed our most vulnerable neighbours to be harmed. We seek courage and forgiveness to be made whole. God of love, we pray for those people, communities and nations already suffering the devastating effects of climate change. And we pray for the diversity of life on earth, so much of it already threatened by our actions. Creator God, we pray for us all that we might restore our relationships with each other and work together to heal the earth. Renew us in your grace for the sake of your creation. Amen. Which passages did you say that I spoke from? John 17, verses 20 to 23.
Thank you. The thing that stuck in my mind as you were speaking was Shell saying, well, we have to do this because we owe our investors good return and we're not getting good enough return. And we've known for a long time that we have power through our superannuation accounts to find out what they're investing in. And so I've just been reminded to have another look. And I think that's a conversation we can have with our neighbours and friends too, just to sort of, you know, not tell them what to do, but ask them to have a look and see if they think that their superannuation funds are... I mean, there's billions of dollars tied up in superannuation funds, and we, if there's one little area where we have a tiny bit of power.
I think that's a fantastic reminder, absolutely. For many of us, we may have already done that, but how many little conversations can we have that people may change because they just didn't know? Yeah, it's great.
Thank you very much. I really appreciated everything you said. One of the things that I regretted about history is that religion has often just created goodies and baddies, as if Jesus came down to draw a line in the sand and say, all the good people on my side and all the bad people over there. And I love the way you reintroduced the whole concept of communion with all living things, including trees. You know, and the thing that I'm wondering as a result of that is, how do we become recognizers of Christ in those who oppress the environment? So how do we sit down and recognise Christ in the corporate leader of Shell? And how do we recognise that Christ is present in the person who thinks that they rely on fracking for their well-being? You know, that's, for me, a really intricate challenge, not to create them as a baddie, but to recognise that they are the created and loved, beloved of Christ.
Absolutely, great question. And I think it just comes back to, I've probably been climate aware for 15, 20 years, but I think of, I'm 47 now, but I think of my actions in my 20s or my ignorance, etc. And I think if we can just always place ourselves in that place, in that, not to say that I feel like people who, like CEOs of Shell and other big oil companies, they do know better and they should know better and they're clearly just not listening. But at the same time, yes, we can place ourselves in their shoes, but we can also just remember that that is human sin, and at the end of the day, God still has grace for that as well. So we do what we might do in any... The same principles apply, I think, in terms of non-violent direct action principles. So we, within the bounds of love and care and respect, we continue to call people to account and continue to call people to account for their actions, not demising their character and their self, but simply reminding them that their actions are wrong and are sinful. Mm. Perhaps not in those words, though.
I just want to thank you for your courage today in starting where you started. It was bloody uncomfortable to hear that litany of where we are and then where you went. And I, many of you, for me, the heart, living with the heartbreak of that and not looking away from it is what is challenging. And the thing that I, the person I found most helpful in that is an eco-warrior who's now in her 80s, Joanna Macy. And she's got a brilliant book, co-authored multiple editions, called Act of Hope, How to Stay Sane or something in a crazy world. And as an eco-warrior back in the beginning, she this is a spiritual practice from a Buddhist background of what's the spiritual practice that allows us to hold this space. And she's got a big body of work called, it's retreat work, called the Work That Reconnects. And it's a spiritual practice cycle, individual and collectively, that starts with, start with gratitude, honour our pain, acknowledging our... So it's a spiritual practice that is not walking away, but how do we sit with gratitude? How do we honour our pain, which leads us to see the world and reconnect differently? It's a brilliant cycle, but allows you to sit with the pain of it and the heartbreak of it. I'll send it out, but if you Google Act of Hope, Joanna Macy, you'll find it.
And I think that's great that we are sharing resources and spiritual practices that work with us, work for us, and might work for somebody else. But I think just that absolute central two tenets of that is just staying connected to yourself and staying connected to others. So however that can happen as well, staying connected to God through spiritual practice, of course, but when we make sure that all those three things happen together, then that's where I think the power is in keeping us grounded. Mm. Yeah.
She talks a lot about the power of stories. And she talks about three stories, the first story being...
The business of usual story, there's nothing wrong, the denial. The great catastrophe that is completely unravelling and it's a disaster we can do nothing about. And the middle choice is the great turning.
Yes.
Where we can't... solve it, but we can choose what we stand for and how we live, which is part of creating the shift.
I don't know that I really have a question. I guess I think a lot of the conversation is in that first place that Michael talked about, nothing to see here, nothing to talk about, we're just not going to talk about it. And then at the same time, the people I know in their 20s, and you know, even my children, they're in that space of the third place of, this is a disaster and a catastrophe, and what's the point anymore? Like, why should I participate in anything? You know, even the young people at this church who have grown into young adults, some of them are like, well, why should I participate in an economy that is literally fucking us? Like, we are going to be screwed by this. And I'm really stuck, I guess. I feel that stuckness.
I've had another great reminder. I've learnt so much just in myself in conversations in the last 5 months again, and it's just a great reminder that we live in this such a tension space. But then, of course, the question is always, how do we keep retreating from, you know, the idols of consumption and progress, and try and take people with us whilst keeping those relationships and making people uncomfortable in a way that doesn't destroy relationships. That's such a hard one. It really is. And it's such a balance, a delicate balance.
I think you hear politicians talking about the importance of, you know, green things and climate, and you also don't hear those same politicians talking about how good it is that the economy is booming. Can we actually make a difference in this without wrecking the economy that we've got? I mean, is the manufacturing that's going on that's creating the greenhouse gases? If we all stop buying more expensive cars, if we stop buying stuff, if we all bought a lot less stuff, that would help the planet. It would throw millions of people out of work if we all started doing that. We could do that as individuals. We can make decisions, and I do, and I'm sure other people here do, make it a decision and say, I'm not going to buy that, or I'm not going to do this, or I'm not going to travel there because of the effect on the planet. Every time I do that, I'm affecting somebody else's living. We've just got to accept that we've got to... You know, there is going to be pain, lots of it.
And yet there are many economists who talk about that it would be possible for governments to adopt plans for slow degrowth, for planned degrowth, that it's possible for it to happen without ruining economies, without ruining people's livelihood. I know very little about economics, so I'm not sure. But there's certainly economists who say it's possible and we should be doing it, and we should be doing it now. It's a hard one. Mm.
Thanks, Alex. So you've really made us think. One of the areas I think where we can make a difference, my area of special interest is food. And if you look at the food industry, the healthiest foods are the ones that come locally and straight from the earth. Whereas the foods that are doing the most harm are foods that are highly processed and produced by multinationals. So for me, to avoid junk food is not so much an act of self-denial as an act of looking after the planet and the other people. When you look at the figures on the food industry, it's the processing, the packaging and the transport and the advertising that take up nearly all of the energy that could be put to better use. So, as I say, to deny ourselves the treats is a small way we can contribute.
To offer a sense of hope, there is actually, I'm not an economist either, but there's a woman called Marjorie Kelly in the States. There's a whole different theory of economics and living economy. This is called a generative economic model as opposed to an extractive economic model. So the current stock market driven maximizing profit model, which is what's driving it all now, and endless growth. There is a whole, not just a model, generative economy, which is profit making but not profit maximizing, and a whole lot of other things I'll put out. And it's not just theory. In the global financial crisis, when the banks were failing, they were profit-maximising banks. And a big percentage of the banking economy in Europe, which was profit-making, not profit-maximising, and was grounded in local community, was hardly affected. So there's a whole... Cooperatives, fishing. I'll put the author, if anyone's interested, the names out. But there is a whole alternative, large scale economic operating that we just don't hear about.
I don't have much to add, but being Canadian, I was following the news recently because Canada had sent emissaries over to Denmark. So I just wanted to share what I heard about what they're doing in Denmark. They've decided to cease oil industry. And the government is actively, the discourse is calling workers in that industry energy workers and training them into renewable energies. And the reporting is that they're quite proud to, they see it as evolving rather than as a conflict. So I do come from Canada. We do have a very vested oil industry. there as well. And so it is often cast as a great big fight between how are we going to earn our living if you take this away from us, if we can't run a pipeline through Indigenous land and through the mountains and out pump more faster and send it across the continent, you know. But I found it really hopeful to hear about the Danish model. I've been in Denmark once, and they already have a long history of, I don't know what you call it, but where you have the byproduct of the ag industry going in to become land enriching product, and you have a complete cycle where there's... Yeah, they already have a tradition of that, so they're just adding to it. And I thought, well, if one country can do that, then it's just hopeful that there are real solutions out there that are being listened to.